podcast on the 1903.
This is Victoria, producer for the Felon File, a podcast on law enforcement history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains of the United States and beyond. Listen to in 39 countries around the world. Scott Lunsford hosts the Felon File. Scott is a retired American police sergeant. Background and intro music through purpleplanet.com.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of The Felon File. And Victoria, thank you for getting us up and running. And she's running the control board today and doing some recording and editing for us. And as she said, I am your host, Scott Lunsford, allegedly a retired law enforcement officer, researcher, writer, detective, SRO, and all-around wearer of way too many hats. We are coming to you today, recorded, of course, from here in the backwoods of a mountain in western North Carolina. And we do appreciate, like I've said in the past, everyone for listening in, and listening in from all over the world. No matter where you're listening from, get a friend to listen and spread the word about the Felon File. What we refer to as Shade of Blue Stories is what we discuss and talk about here on the Felon File. Now today, our Shade of Blue story is one of my favorite types of stories, a detective story. This one about a detective by the name of Thomas A. McQuaid. I have read that the 1975 British action thriller movie, directed by Douglas Hickox and starring John Wayne as Brannigan, is loosely based on this story. And based on events that occurred in 1903, I don't think so. Not even close. There are maybe a few similarities, but mostly, the detective superintendent of the Pittsburgh Police Department is a better story. However, John Wayne would have done the superintendent of detectives justice by playing him in a movie, and they should have been one. The son of an Irish immigrant, McQuaid had lifted his family from lower class to upper middle class in 1889 when, at the age of 33, he was hired as an operator dispatcher for the Pittsburgh Police Department. At 5'6", McQuaid was thought to be too short to be a patrolman. The idea being that the bad guys would just walk all over top of him. But that wasn't the case. Even though he was hired as a dispatcher, he climbed the ranks anyway, making sergeant of the Southside Police Station 42 days after being hired to answer telephones. And while advancing to the detective's office, he was involved with several cases. One of note, the recapturing of the infamous Biddle brothers, the two men who had led the chloroform gang and terrorized Pittsburgh in the early 1900s. The Biddles were arrested in April of 1901 at a house in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania. For over a year, the group had been overpowering victims with chloroform or any other substance like ether that they could get a hold of before robbing them. Caught, tried, and convicted on December 12, 1901 for the murder of a shopkeeper. They were locked up in the Allegheny County Jail to await hanging. Now, while there was a young lady, Kate Soffel, the wife of Warden Peter Soffel. She frequently met with prisoners in her efforts as a good person to rehabilitate them. Unfortunately, a relationship soon developed with brother Eddie Biddle. The relationship led to her helping the brothers escape by smuggling saws and guns into them in her husband's county jail. The story is somewhat reminiscent of Vicky White, the ex-corrections officer accused of helping Alabama inmate escape. She took her own life following a car chase with police after the car they were trying to escape in crashed. Unfortunately, Casey survived. back to 1901 and 1902, though. One night, after lights out, the Biddle brothers sawed through the bars of their cells. At around 4 a.m., one of them called out that his brother was sick. As a jailer approached, Jack Biddle lunged through a cut opening in the bars, grabbed the jailer, and pulled him through. Once out of the cell, Jack threw the jailer over a railing to the stone floor 16 feet below. Brother Ed shot and wounded a second guard that was on duty. Securing the guards and changing from their prison clothes into the officer's street clothes, they left the prison to meet with Sophie 3 hours before they were noticed that they were missing. Making it all the way to Westview, Pennsylvania, on a farm, the three stole a team of horses and a sleigh, also locating and stealing a shotgun to add to the arsenal that Mrs. Soffel had already provided and smuggled into them. The fellow detective, Charles Buck McGovern, also involved with the original arrest, Thomas A. McQuaid put together a posse and went after them. They were caught in a shootout soon followed. One brother was killed and the other was injured. Mrs. Soffel received a gunshot wound to her shoulder. She was charged with aiding with the escape and did her time in prison. This was in fact made into a movie in 1984 called Mrs. Soffel, starring Diane Keaton and Mel Gibson. Check it out. It's not a bad flick. For today's main Shana Blue story, though, we go to September 26, 1903. Thomas McQuaid was vacationing with his family in Chicago in a rented cabin that looked out over Lake Michigan. The vacation had long been overdue for McQuaid, bringing the constantly working superintendent of Pittsburgh's Detective Bureau in for some much-needed rest. After waking up at dawn, McQuaid, putting on a blue suit, sat on the cabin porch with Lake Michigan in front of him. He drank his coffee and read the latest newspaper, enjoying himself. As he flipped through the paper, unfortunately, one story jumped out at him. Ferguson Contracting Company, owner murdered and robbed. Assailants, dynamite culvert and steel company payroll. The article read, Samuel T. Ferguson, owner of the Ferguson Contracting Company, was murdered yesterday when someone detonated explosives wired to a culvert in the road he was traveling outside Middleton, Pennsylvania. C.L. Martin, Ferguson's bookkeeper, was injured in the explosion. Martin, a Cincinnati resident, was rushed to a nearby hospital. There he remains in critical condition. Martin and Ferguson had just withdrawn $3,600 from a Washington, Pennsylvania bank. They were headed back to the contracting company, the Ferguson's contracting company's work site and campsite to pay its employees. The contracting company graded a portion of the Wabash Railroad line that was connecting Pittsburgh with Washington, Pennsylvania. Lewis Liggett, who owned a farm just down the road from the culvert, he was plowing his cornfield when he heard the explosion and looked up. He's quoted in the paper as saying, they must have set it off the moment those horses were over the culvert, because it was raining bits and pieces of horses. Whenever everything settled, I saw a man run down the hill and out of the woods. He grabs a satchel out of the buggy, or what was left of it, and disappeared back into the woods. I'd never seen him before. After reading the article, McQuaid gave a big sigh. He folded the newspaper, stared at the water of Lake Michigan for a few minutes, and then finished his coffee. Ran his hand through his graying wavy hair, no doubt, and scratched his ear. How do I know that? McQuaid was known for his enormous ears that curved the top of his earlobe. He took a lot of ribbing on this feature, but took it in stride and didn't let it bother. Finally, he stood up and went inside the cabin where his wife, Annie, had been making breakfast. Interrupting her in the kitchen, he broke the news that the vacation was over way earlier than they anticipated. he had to go home. As the news spread by media and word of mouth, Western Pennsylvania was shocked that Samuel Ferguson of the Ferguson Contracting Company had been murdered. Charles Martin, the bookkeeper, being seriously injured as well, was also of major concern. The highway robbers had apparently used a homemade bomb buried or hidden in the roadway to blow apart the wagon and the horses. What today we'd refer to as an IED. The robber or robbers had taken, like the paper said, $3,600, the entire payroll for the work camp. The two men had carried this in a satchel. They basically just grabbed the money from the wreckage of the blown-up horse and buggy and ran off. A payday had been established at the construction camp at West Middleton, Pennsylvania, a small town in Washington County, about 35 miles from Pittsburgh. Payday was always on the 25th of the month. That morning, the boss and the bookkeeper had driven to the bank to pick up the money for the workmen. It was recorded that the money was in $2, $5, and $10 bills, with a few larger denominations, and silver coinage. The money was placed in a satchel, and the two men started in the buggy, drawn by two horses, towards the camp. They stopped for a brief dinner at the hotel where Ferguson's wife and daughter lived. After the meal, the two men left the hotel shortly after noon. Continuing on to the work camp about a mile and a half, the two men drove over a bored culvert in a roadway that crossed over a good-sized ditch across the road. The dynamite IED went off just as the horses were on the trench. The massive explosion ripped the horses to pieces. The largest piece and portion of the four animals recovered in the investigation was just one hoof, and blood rained down around all over the scene. When dynamite goes off, the bulk of the force goes straight up. The animals were directly above the IED. The buggy was wrecked. Mr. Martin was so severely injured that he spent 4 months in the hospital, but did survive. Mr. Ferguson was killed instantaneously. The satchel containing the money was taken from the buggy, and the murderers fled. This was the bare outline of the most famous case ever handled by the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania Bureau of Detectives. The Ferguson Contracting Company was a Pittsburgh business with its main offices there, and the city's detectives rushed to the attack scene and joined Washington County Sheriff's authorities in searching for the bandits. On a hillside overlooking the culvert, behind a stump, they found an electric battery, the type used by professional explosive companies. A line of wire led from the battery to the culvert where the IED had been placed. An old double-barreled shotgun was also discovered. The original stock had been replaced on it with a very well-made hand-carved stock. There were also numerous cigarette butts, burn matches, and marks on the ground. Physical evidence and tracks left behind indicated that at least two men had been involved at the crime scene. Manhunts and posses were organized, and the county was scoured for miles around the bomb site looking for the suspects, but with no luck. Behind the hill that overlooked the crime scene, the satchel, without the money, of course, was found. It had been ripped open or cut open. A knife with a broken blade was also located close by. Lewis Liggett, the farmer plowing the field, and who stated he observed a man running into the road and take the satchel, told detectives that if he saw the man again, he could identify him as the man who took the satchel. Now, like I said, the unsophisticated murderers and robbers did leave behind a lot of physical evidence. John Kelly, a teamster who had been stopped from the road by two men near the culvert before the explosion occurred, they had stopped him and asked him for matches, which he had given them. He was able to also provide a description of the men, but said he did not know who they were. Well, by this time, McQuaid had made it home from vacation, was at his office. The detectives working on the case made their reports to him, and McQuaid invited the newspaper reporters in who had been at the scene and also who had written the accounts of the tragedy. They came to him with their theories, as well as the theories from the detectives. The theories were that the crime was the work of a Western mob of professionals who had been watching the men and knew when the payroll was expected. Chief Detective McQuaid, he didn't go for that, though. He refused to accept these theories. And this is what he told the detectives and reporters. The crime was not the work of English-speaking hold-up men, but the result of foreigners familiar with dynamite. An English-speaking mobster, the superintendent began, would have held the men up and given them a chance for their lives. However, the fact the murderers sat on a hillside where they could see the road for 3/4 of a mile and calmly saw the men drive down to the culvert and then calmly set off the charges of dynamite convinces me that they were foreigners of low intelligence. Now, that's pushing it a bit, but it's interesting. They now have more money than they have ever had, Chief Detective said, and the first trace of them will come from somewhere where they're spending the stolen money or trying to get out of the country. Now, of course, the reporters grabbed this theory and ran with it. It was published in all the newspapers. And when the news spread, it took about 2 weeks after the murder. Numerous leads had been run down and tips were run down, all to dead ends. When an old Irishman came into the detective bureau asking to see Chief Detective McQuaid. And when he first showed up, he was put off or ignored by the other detective after he had told him that he had had information to give McQuaid. He was told that Mr. McQuaid was busy and couldn't see him. Well, the stubborn Irishman sat down and said, well, I'll just wait here until I see him. Well, McQuaid, who'd heard his voice, recognized the old man as an old friend of his father's and ordered a man to be brought in to him. The man came in, asking him if he was Thomas McQuaid. Apparently, he didn't recognize him at first. Yes, I am Thomas McQuaid. Well, the old Irishman said, I have something to tell you that prevents me from sleeping at night. The Irishman began his story by telling the chief detective he kept a saloon on Brownsville Road. He had read in the papers what McQuaid had said about the men who had killed Ferguson. And he related, some days ago, 2 Croatians were in my bar drinking. They had plenty of money, mostly in small bills. And they spent it more freely than I have ever known Croatian foreigners of that class to ever do. He told the chief detective that, as a rule, Croatians were a very saving people. And still, these fellows were drinking heavily and buying drinks for everybody that they could see, especially anybody they identified as a countryman. They paid almost entirely with $2 bills. When the old man gave such a good description of the two men, McQuaid went and visited the saloon and secured the money that had been sent. One piece of essential police work that was done, and is even done today, McQuaid conducted a neighborhood canvass to try to locate information that some may not have even been aware of was needed. They were aware that they had or that it was valuable. McQuaid made contact with a Croatian businessman who was well connected in the community and always kept his eyes out on his community. He remembered the men, and his description of the suspect matched the old Irish saloon keeper, as well as the other witnesses. McQuaid hired the man to locate them, if possible, and keep track of their movements, and follow the two if they decide to leave. A visit to the Ferguson Company's office in search of their payroll, McQuaid was able to locate 2 suspects, Malover Kokovic and an M. Patrovic, Croatians who had been employed by the company but fired on August 24th.
God, did it again. Correct pronunciation for the Croatian suspects' names is Milivar Kovovic and Milivar Patrovic.
Yes. Thank you again, Victoria. I don't know about you guys, but, you know, sometimes that gets a little annoying. But anyway. If you recall, Payday and the attack were on the 26th. Their description of the men by the foreman, the timekeepers, and other employees matched all the other descriptions they had from the saloon keeper and the Croatian businessmen and the farmer. It was also learned that after their discharge, they had remained around the construction camp gambling with other workers, mostly Croatians with the same language. The two men soon disappeared about the time of the murder. One of the men, Kokovic, when he had worked for the company, had been working as a powder monkey, or an assistant to the men who did the blasting, and he was very well acquainted with the manner of exploding dynamite charges by electricity. McQuaid had identified his suspects, and he was confident enough that he was able to get warrants issued for their arrest, and circulars with their descriptions were printed and distributed. The man that McQuaid had hired, a Croatian businessman, learned that two men using those names had purchased tickets recently for Europe and Croatia at the steamship agency office inside the First National Bank. The men had also exchanged $2,400 in American currency for Austrian money of an equivalent value. Now, remember, we were talking about 1903. $2,400 in 1903 is equivalent to spending capital of about $82,943.73 today. The clerk at the bank who sold the tickets and arranged for the exchange of the money remembered the description, and guess what? It matched everybody else's. He also gave the numbers of the men who had purchased the ticket for passage on the American liner, the Philadelphia. Superintendent McQuaid cabled the chief of police at Southampton, England, in Hamburg, Germany, to arrest the men upon their arrival. He provided them with details of the crime for which they were wanted, stated they would be extradited back to the United States to answer these murder charges. He didn't have to keep them long, just hold them till I can get there. Detective Richard Kelly of the Pittsburgh Bureau of Detectives learned that the old gun, which had been found at the scene near the battery, was actually the property of Kokovic. It had been broken, or he had broken the stock, and an Austrian employed by the company, who was a gun maker back home, he had repaired it, did a very good job doing so, apparently. Kokovic had traded the gun to another man at the camp for whiskey, but the day before the holdup, it disappeared from the shack where it was being kept. McQuaid also learned that a few days after the holdup, the two men had arrived at a place called Mingo Junction, where another construction camp was located, where they in fact ended up losing $400 gambling. At this camp, they were asked about, "Where the heck did you get this money?" Kokovic simply said, and asked them if they'd heard of the big contractor being blown up, and left it at that. Detective Kelly also established that the two men had been in the Ferguson camp near West Middleton the night before the explosion. With all this information being forwarded on to the authorities of Southampton, England, they acted quickly after receiving McQuaid's telegram and follow-up telegrams. When the ship docked, two men were arrested and held. Word of the arrest was sent to Pittsburgh, and this is when the first issues apparently showed up. When the extradition process was started, I have discovered that the arrest had not been exactly legal per State Department requirements. The application for the arrest should have been made to the governor of Pennsylvania, then from him to the State Department in Washington, D.C., who would contact the State Department authorities in England and ask for assistance. McQuaid, having skipped over a few steps in his rush to locate his perpetrators. Now, Scotland Yard, having dealt with such issues before, the Yard authorities just held on to the two bad guys based on suspicion alone. This allowed the correct forms and processes to be completed and sent on. On November 4th, 1903, Superintendent McQuaid and Detective Kelly left New York for England with the proper paperwork in hand. Arriving in London, a hearing was given to the men in the Bow Street Police Court, and then they were remanded to Brixton Prison until they could be taken back for a final hearing on extradition proceedings. During a search of the prisoners while at Paxton Prison, 17 $2 bills were found hidden on one of the two men. The final hearing on the extradition was before Justice Fenwick of the King's Bench. The formal affidavits were supplemented by a great mass of evidence touching on the details of the crime furnished by Superintendent McQuaid and the testimony of Detective Kelly. The justices privately complimented them for presenting the case, and the prisoners were turned over to them on December 7th. Chief Hare of Scotland Yard also complimented greatly McQuaid on his presentation of the case. After viewing all the evidence that was brought with them, the photographs and statements, Chief Hare told the chief detective, "It is one of the most remarkable cases I have ever had under my observation. Your photographs indicate that no houses are in sight which might have been permitted a witness of the deed. It is exceptional how you have woven the slender threads into a complete net." The chief of Scotland Yard also added, "I hesitate to say it, but I think my men couldn't have accomplished such work. It's undoubtedly marvelous." Now, the Croatians, who did not appeal the justice's decisions, were turned over to the detectives, and the two detectives and their prisoners departed England for Liverpool aboard the Teutonic on December 9th. Another issue came up. At the time of the sailing, it seems the names of the prisoners had been printed on the sailing manifest, and the manager of the line came on board and told McQuaid that he would not be permitted to sail with his prisoners. "You can't go on my ship." His reasoning was that many of the ladies making the trip would object to the prisoners being on board, and it would injure the prestige of the line. Now, being a good Yankee, and I say that complimentary, Superintendent McQuaid refused to leave the ship with his prisoners. It took the captain, or the admiral of the Royal Navy, to establish rules for the conduct of the detective and their prisoners during the journey to New York before the manager was satisfied enough to allow them to travel. Now, the manager's fears about its effect on the ladies making the trip was a little entirely unfounded, for the detectives and their prisoners were the chief centers of interest during the entire voyage. Now, the voyage itself had another couple of issues that came up, but they were typical for the time and the situation. Rough seas were encountered almost the entire way, and the prisoners were seasick most of the time. The men were kept shackled during the voyage and only allowed out to stretch their legs at night after the rest of the passengers had retired. They indicated they could speak little English, but spoke mostly in their own language. Although, they declared at the trial, both in Bow Street and the final extradition hearing, that they did not know where Washington, Pennsylvania was, did not know who the Ferguson Company was. They admitted to the two detectives on the trip that they did work for the Ferguson Company, though. The two prisoners on the trip played cards with each other and often amused the officers by doing card tricks. They talked about everything except the murder. And when it was mentioned, they would simply say, "I do not understand." On the banks of Newfoundland, the ship ran into a dense fog with seas that washed over the decks. It wasn't a lot of fun for the two prisoners changing their beds and now unable to go up on deck. On December 13th, the vessel encountered another variety of weather. There was bright sunshine at one point, rain, hail, and snow, and fog at another, and one sharp flash of lightning actually struck the foremast of the ship, clipping off the globe off of a spar and sending it crashing to the deck and then overboard into the sea. At another point, a fire started in the cabin from crossed wires, and the steam heat pipes burst. Passengers and crew went to bed shivering cold from lack of heat. And some people on board were afraid the whole thing was going to sink with them. The old theory of bringing a murderer onto a sailing ship. Once arriving in New York, though, the men were happily transported to Washington, Pennsylvania, where they were jailed. Very happy to be back on dry land. At the trial, which took place the second week in February of 1904, the men demanded separate trials, and courts agreed and it was granted. Kokovic was tried first. After a 10-day trial, he was convicted of murder in the first degree. He ended up being hung in the Washington County Jail on September 8th, 1904. My wife and my sister's birthday. Not 1904, but September 8th. The other prisoner was convicted of manslaughter and given 20 years. Before his execution, Kokovic sent for the district attorney, Mr. Underwood, and confessed. He also asked to speak to Detective McQuay. He admitted that they had stolen the battery wire and 100 pounds of dynamite from the supply house of the Ferguson Company the night before the murder. They had taken the boards off the culvert in the road and placed their dynamite in the hollow. And then they replaced the boards and covered them up with dirt. And all through the night and in the morning of September 25th, they remained near the culvert, and when passing horses would scatter the dirt off the cracks in the ditch, they would go out and recover them up again. When they saw the team driven by Mr. Ferguson coming, they got behind the stump where the battery was located, and just as the horses' heads were over the culvert, they pushed the plunger. Kokovic said it rained flesh and blood for 5 minutes after the explosion. He retrieved the satchel and remembered seeing Lucas Liggett, the farmer, plowing in the field. He also remembered another witness that they didn't know about till later, a black minister fishing in the river on the other side of the hill where the money was taken from the satchel. In talking to him about his confession, Superintendent McQuaid remarked, "You had dynamite enough to have killed 20 men." Kokovic simply grinned and replied, "I had enough dynamite to have killed the devil." Now that says a lot right there. That's our Shade of Blue story. Hope you found it interesting. 1903, IEDs were, even then, serious business. Well, thank you for listening. Be sure to come back and in 2 weeks for another episode of The Felon File. Or if you like, check out some of our pre-recorded podcasts. They're all available on the website. You can find a link to the podcast platform at my website, felonfile.com, or at scottlunsfordauthor.com. A few of the other things we have for sale there at the website, coffee mugs and some t-shirts and the like. Nothing says leave me alone in the morning better than having your morning cup of coffee at work out of a Felon File coffee mug. Well, remember, in the coming week, if you have the opportunity, do something nice for somebody, do something good. If more people did that, the world would be a better place. And we need the world to be a better place. In the meantime, y'all be safe, be secure. And we'll talk to you again later on another episode of The Felon File. Victoria, I'm turning it back over to you. I'm going to throw the switch on the control panel. Bye, y'all.
This has been The Felon File, a discussion on law enforcement, history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains and other parts of the world. For more information, you can go to felonfile.com or scottlunsfordauthor.com. Here you can find links to Scott and Numb books and other information. You can also email us at felonfile@gmail.com. There are also t-shirts and mugs available. You can also buy us a cup of coffee. Or help purchase some of the research material and expenses it takes to do Felon File. Click on the coffee image on the webpage to do so. This is Victoria, your producer. Thank you for listening. Have a good one.